This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Hello. Well, we've got some pretty deep questions this time around, which I'm going to try and tackle. The first one is from Philip Lariche. He refers to a previous Ask an Astronomer in which Tim said that the isotropy of the universe implies that it was all in thermal equilibrium at some time in the past. And Philip says, could it be that actually different regions of the universe were never in thermal equilibrium, but just had the same temperature because they came from the same sort of process? And as an extension, could we find out one day that all physical constants have to have the values that they do? Well, this is really deep. So let's just explain all the bits of the question. Firstly, what did Tim mean? Well, he said that the universe is isotropic, which means it looks the same in all directions. Not exactly the same, of course, but generally the same on large scales. So we see structures of the same sizes all around us, galaxies, clusters of galaxies, and so on. And more than that, we can detect the cosmic microwave background, which is radiation that was emitted about 400,000 years after the start of the universe, and now comes at us from everywhere. And no matter which direction it comes from, it has almost exactly the same temperature, which means the same brightness, essentially. Astronomers think that all this sameness is weird. So why? Well, we think the universe started with a Big Bang, that it was very small and hot at the beginning, and that space then actually expanded and dragged things apart from one another. Observations of faraway galaxies tell us that the Big Bang happened about 14 billion years ago, and that the universe is still expanding today. Now, light has a certain speed, which means that when we look far away, we're looking at things as they were long ago. And some things could be so far away that their light has not had time to reach us since the start of the universe. And when we look really far in opposite directions, it seems as though the light should not have had time to travel from one side to the other since the universe began. Because light is the fastest thing that exists, that means that these two sides should not have had any contact with each other at all, ever. So we think that the fact that they do look the same, and the fact that the cosmic microwave background all looks the same, means that there was a time when every part of the universe was in contact. We explain this by postulating that there was a period of extremely rapid expansion of space shortly after the Big Bang, and we call this inflation. It means expansion that was faster than light, and believe it or not, this is possible when you're talking about space itself expanding. And this inflation took things that were once in contact out of contact with each other. Then expansion slowed down. So when we look across the universe, everything looks similar because even those very far away parts of the universe were once in contact with each other. Tim talked about thermal equilibrium, meaning that all the parts of the universe had about the same temperature in the past, and the cosmic microwave background therefore also has about the same temperature everywhere. And thermal equilibrium can only happen when things are in contact with each other. So that's the previous question Philip was referring to. But he says, well, what if inflation isn't actually the explanation? And that's fair enough, because we don't currently know why it should have happened. He says, what if these far-flung areas of the universe weren't in touch with each other, but just started off basically the same, under the same physical laws, and therefore turned out the same? And he uses a very nice analogy of two cups of coffee. They come from the same machine, so they turn out the same. It doesn't mean that they were ever in contact with one another. Now, the reason the early universe doesn't work like cups of coffee lies in the murky world of quantum physics. And you might not be too surprised to learn that it all comes down to what we call the uncertainty principle. This is a fundamental part of quantum physics because quantum physics describes everything as waves. And it means that you can't know all the physical properties of a system to perfect accuracy at the same time. There's always some uncertainty, hence the name. And this uncertainty is not about having bad instruments to measure things. It can't be overcome even with the best instruments. And the result is that two different systems can have different properties even if they should be exactly the same. They're never the same, because within that uncertainty, they can be different for no reason at all. Now, philosophers may argue about the absolute truth of this, but it's certainly the model that quantum physics describes, and that's always been a very good model for describing reality. But uncertainty is only noticeable in systems normally if they are very small or have very concentrated energy, like the early universe. It doesn't describe cups of coffee very well because they're comparatively big and have quite low energy, so their behaviour is predictable. But in the early universe, areas that are not in touch with each other could be different just because of quantum uncertainty. They could have different amounts of energy and different temperatures. Even within an area, you can get fluctuations, so differences in temperature and density, which are tiny, but inflation blows them up much bigger so that they result in the structures we see today, galaxies and so on. In a universe that's all in contact, the temperature balances out so that the fluctuations are of similar sizes everywhere, which is what we observe when we see this isotropic universe now. So to answer your main question, Philip, if bits of the early universe weren't in contact with each other, we would expect quantum uncertainty to leave them looking quite different nowadays. Different sizes of structures and different temperatures for the cosmic microwave background. The fact that it all looks the same suggests that everything was in touch just after the Big Bang. So it seems that you can't make the universe exactly the same way twice. This leads to the other part of Philip's question. Might we one day find out that all physical constants have to have the values they do? That mathematically, it's the only way things can work. So that's specific numbers like the speed of light and what's called Big G, which quantifies the strength of gravity. Now, this really is fundamental. And the answer is that we have no special reason for thinking that physical constants or the laws of physics would have to be the same in different universes. If there are regions that have never been in contact with us, we can call them separate universes, and we think that they could have different values for the physical constants. Now, of course, measuring the speed of light in meters per second, for example, is arbitrary because we've defined the size of a meter and we've defined the length of a second. But if you compare the constants to each other, you can get quantities that don't depend on that. One famous one is called the fine structure constant, which tells us about the strength of the electromagnetic force. It's a combination of other constants multiplied together, and the result is that it has no units. Its value is about 1 over 137, or, if you like decimal, 0.007. And as far as we know, this number could be totally different in another universe. As far as we know. But interestingly, if some constants didn't have the values they do, then you wouldn't get things like atoms forming from protons and electrons. So it seems as though the constants are fine-tuned in such a way that interesting things like atoms and planets and human beings can arise. Some people think this is evidence that there are multiple universes with all different physical laws, and that we are here because our universe happened to have just the right numbers to allow us to develop. Now, whether you believe that or not, I can't tell you whether physical constants could definitely have different values in another universe. But we think they could, because we don't know of any good reason why not. Okay, let's go on to a slightly more practical question. Charles Woolley found a back-of-the-envelope calculation on the internet about how far away radio transmissions can be detected from. He says he read that a radio dish 2.8 kilometres across would be needed to detect alien television signals from Alpha Centauri, our nearest star after the Sun. That's assuming they use the same TV transmitting power that we Earthlings do. He wants to know whether you could detect the same signal with an interferometer which had a baseline of 2.8 kilometres. And he also wants to know if we could produce pictures and sounds from the signal. First off, I have to admit I haven't done the calculations myself. The Lovell telescope at Jodrell Bank is 76 metres across, so a radio telescope 2.8 kilometres across would be enormous. That's 2,800 metres. Having said that, in about 12 years' time, we'll have the Square Kilometre Array, or SKA, which will be much larger than any radio telescope we have now. Its collecting area of 1 million square metres will be equivalent to a dish 1.1 kilometres in diameter, which is very big, but still behind the 2.8 kilometres that Charles read. But I found a recent paper by some American researchers who looked at what we could detect with the SKA. They think that TV transmissions like our own could be picked up 50 light years away by the SKA. And Alpha Centauri is only about 4 light years away, so they're actually more optimistic than the source Charles found. And I'll link to that paper in the show notes. So the main question is, would an interferometer with a baseline of 2.8 kilometers be just as good as a dish with a diameter of 2.8 kilometers? And the answer is no. An interferometer, in terms of radio, is a collection of receivers, which you point all at the same thing, and then correlate their signals together in a special way so that they act as one big telescope. So the SKA will have many, many dishes and receivers, and it will be an interferometer. The main reason for using interferometers is to make radio images. So first of all, I want you to dispel any idea that radio waves are sound, because they aren't. They're a type of light. And that means that we can make images of things which emit radio waves. So quasars, for example, can produce lovely images, and I'll link to one of those as well in the show notes. Now, making a good radio image is hard, because the wavelength of a radio wave is much longer than the wavelength of a visible light wave, and that means the resolution you get is not as good. So small things in the image become fuzzy. But if you can make your radio telescope bigger, you can improve the resolution so that you can see small details. So the further apart you put your receivers in an interferometer, the better the resolution gets. Sometimes astronomers do interferometry with telescopes that are separated by thousands of kilometers just to get a sharper image. The separation between two receivers is called a baseline. So when Charles referred to an interferometer with a baseline of 2.8 kilometers, you've got to imagine two receivers or dishes 2.8 kilometers apart. But what you don't get by moving the dishes further apart is any improvement in sensitivity. Sensitivity is the ability to detect faint radio emission. So you can imagine moving your dishes further apart and getting a sharper image, but the image won't get any brighter overall. The sensitivity depends on the total collecting area of the dishes, so the areas of each dish added together. In other words, you can only collect as much light as the individual receivers collect. If you're trying to detect alien broadcasts, you're not interested in trying to make an image of a large object that's out there in space. You just want to home in on the signal given off by the alien's radio transmitter. So you make your collecting area as big as you can, but you don't worry about the spacing of your dishes. However, you might use an interferometer because it's an easier way of adding collecting area than building one gigantic and very heavy dish. Now, there are other ways to improve your telescope sensitivity. One is bandwidth, which means how much of the frequency band you're looking at. It's like the range of colours that an optical telescope looks at. Hopefully, ET emits a signal with a very narrow bandwidth, which is equivalent to them concentrating all their signal into one colour instead of spreading it out all across the rainbow. That way, we can concentrate on just that frequency range and ignore everything else, and that helps to exclude noise or radio crackle. And we can also try to reduce the noise as much as possible so that the signal comes through. One way to do this is to make your receiver very cold, because a warm receiver actually generates noise inside itself. Another way, of course, is to just try to get away from all the man-made radio noise given out by mobile phones, electrical power lines, and that sort of stuff. And this does give us one good reason for using an interferometer to try to detect aliens. Interferometers are made to detect signals which are the same at all the receivers. Signals that aren't the same at each receiver get rejected automatically by the process of interferometry. So if your dishes are far enough apart, the noise environment that they're in will be different, allowing you to mostly ignore that noise. Not completely, but mostly. So let's say the aliens happen to broadcast on the same frequency as BBC One in the UK. By correlating signals between a receiver in the UK and another one in the USA, where you don't have BBC One broadcasting on that frequency, you can pretty much ignore BBC One. Whereas the alien TV show will be detected in both the UK and the USA. So there's a good reason for using an interferometer. The last part of the question was, could we produce pictures and sounds from an alien signal? Well, in principle, yes. If you have a good mobile phone, it can give you pictures, sounds, text, any data, basically, from the radio waves it receives. It is all encoded into the radio waves. The problem is, if it came from aliens, then how will we interpret it? Which bits of the data should be turned into pictures, and which into sounds? We'd have to experiment and see if we could get anything out of it. If the signal is very weak when it reaches us, that might be difficult. You'd hope for some very simple and clearly encoded information. it might be hard to separate all the data for complex images and sounds in a weak signal. But in any case, an interferometer would be just as good for this as a single dish. The main thing will be to have as much collecting area as possible and to exclude as much unwanted noise as possible. Okay, on to the last question. It's quite a deep one again. CJ asks, if time passes at different rates, depending on the gravitational field, why don't satellites disappear? Shouldn't they gradually move into the future and then blink out of existence? Well, fortunately, no. But time does indeed pass at different rates depending on the strength of the gravitational field you're in. The stronger the gravity, the slower time goes. And that's a prediction of Einstein's general theory of relativity. So down here on the surface of the Earth, gravity is stronger than it is where satellites are, hundreds or maybe thousands of kilometres above the Earth's surface. And so yes, time passes more slowly for us than it does for the satellites. Now that's weird, so it might be good to just think about what it actually means, the rate of time passing. We measure the passage of time by how long one process takes compared to another process. So, for example, how much does a clock move on in the time it takes Usain Bolt to run 100 metres? Well, his world record is 9.58 seconds. Usain Bolt running 100 metres is one process. 9.58 seconds passing on a clock is another process. This is all you can do. There is no absolute measure of how fast time passes. You can only compare one thing to another. So if we somehow construct a running track up among the satellites orbiting the Earth, and if we suppose that Usain Bolt will always run his 100 metres in exactly the same way, then a clock up there on the satellite will measure Usain up there doing the 100 metres in 9.58 seconds. Nothing will seem faster or slower. The difference only comes if we can somehow use a clock on the satellite to measure Usain Bolt's 100 metres when he's on Earth. Now we're comparing processes between two strengths of gravitational field. Now Usain will run 100 metres on Earth, and the satellite clock will record a time of more than 9.58 seconds. Let's say 10.58 seconds. Actually, the real effect will be much smaller, but let's just exaggerate it so it's really noticeable. From the point of view of the satellite, Usain, down here on Earth, appears to be running rather slower than usual. And all processes on the Earth similarly appear slow. And if Usain can somehow observe the clock on the satellite, he's going to think it ticks rather too quickly. So that's what it means. Earthbound clocks fall further and further behind clocks on satellites. This actually happens because on GPS satellites there are very accurate clocks and we can measure this effect. There's also another smaller effect due to the rotation of satellites and of the Earth's surface, but I'm ignoring that one. In terms of the existence of the satellite, remember that time is only a measure of the time of one process compared to another. In relativity, you normally talk about events, where an event is anything that we can measure a place and a time for. So you're an event right now. In a minute you might be sitting in the same place, but you'll be a different event because you exist at a different time. Or you might get up to make a cup of tea, and then you'll be an event in a different place as well as a different time. You could even define the atoms in your body as a separate event. The funny thing is, according to relativity, we can't always agree on the place and time of an event. Down here, we measure Usain Bolt as running 100 metres in 9.58 seconds. Up there, the clock says he did it in 10.58 seconds. But we can always agree on the events themselves. No matter how you look at it, Usain definitely ran a race. He started in the starting blocks, and he finished at the finish line. We can't agree exactly when and where it happened, but it definitely happened. Now let's say the satellite goes round the Earth 1,000 times before it gets decommissioned, and then it's directed towards Earth and burns up in the atmosphere. The clocks on Earth and on the satellite won't agree about the amount of time that's passed during those 1,000 orbits. But all observers will be able to agree that the satellite launched, orbited 1,000 times, and then got burned up. It's the events that matter. This means that the satellite won't ever blink out of existence, however much its clock ends up disagreeing with one on Earth. And this is one of the big conceptual leaps that marked Einstein out as such a genius. Events are absolute, time and space are relative. To put it another way, things define space and time, not the other way around. And one wonderful thing about GPS is that the difference in the rate at which time passes is taken into account in the clocks on board GPS satellites. They were made to tick a little bit slower before they were launched. If they hadn't been, the time signals broadcast down to Earth would get out of sync with us by about 40 microseconds each day, which doesn't sound a lot, but it means that the location measured by your sat-nav would drift by about 10 kilometers every day. So there is the theory of relativity in daily life. I hope your heads can cope with all of that. Thank you very much for the questions, and please do keep sending them in by all the available means.